As long as you're here, great.
I'm going to open up the House Committee on Human Services on Wednesday, March 30th, 2011. And we're going to be going out of order this morning. The first thing we're going to do is have a public hearing on House Bill 2237. And Jennifer?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2237 recreates the Public Guardian and Conservator Task Force. It sunsets the task force July 1st, 2013 and declares an emergency effective on passage. It does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Great. Representative, thank you for coming today and bringing two guests.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Michael Dembro, State Representative for House District 45. That's Northeast Portland to Park Rose. And it's with both a great deal of pleasure and sadness that I come before you. Sadness because I'm just reminded how much I miss being on this committee.
Oh, we miss you.
Yes. And, you know, one of the great things about being on the Human Services Committee is just the range of human conditions that you're exposed to, situations, challenges, frankly. And what I bring before you today has to do with one of the things I learned when I was on the committee, and that is the challenge that we have in this state dealing with people who do not have the capacity to make decisions for themselves. This is a very serious problem in this state, and 2 years ago, legislation coming out of this committee, House Bill 2883, created a task force on public guardianship conservatorship, a subject that really I knew nothing about. And it was only when I woke up from the haze of the session that I realized I'd somehow been appointed to this task force. It was a very productive experience for me. I learned an awful lot. And this was a task force that has worked for 2 years, I should say, at no compensation at all, at no cost to the legislature or to the people. The cost in time and money has been to the participants. I brought before you the tentative report from the task force. I don't know if you have it with you on the dais, but you'll see in that document the list of the members of the task force, and you'll see it was a great group of, including a district attorney, a couple of judges, many people working in the field, representative from Disabilities Rights Oregon, to deal with this issue. I have with me two of the members of that task force, Jeff Brandon, who's a retired member of the Multnomah County Public Guardianship Program and currently on the Governor's Commission on Seniors Services, and Judge Claudia Burton from Marion County, who's also a member of the task force. The what this bill, 2237, does very simply is it asks your permission to allow these good people to continue to abuse themselves at no expense for another 2 years. The task force looked at a variety of programs around the country. It looked at the needs here in the state for public guardianship. And let me step back and just remind you of the kind of situation that we're dealing with here. These are people who've been deemed by the courts to be incapable of making decisions for themselves because of perhaps age-related dementia or mental health issues or addiction issues. And they don't have the means, either personally or through family, to have a guardian appointed to take care of them. And so the public has a responsibility to do that. The administration of such programs in this state is left up to the counties. But of all the counties, really Multnomah County is the only county that has a program. And so otherwise it's a very hit-or-miss kind of thing. And These are very difficult kinds of situations. Jeff can tell you more about them, answer any questions you might have, or Judge Burton can. Often the people who are in a guardianship situation don't want to be there. They want to be making their own decisions, but they really don't have the capacity to do it. So these are very complicated, difficult situations. The tentative recommendation of the task force is for some kind of state entity to be created, which would help the counties to coordinate their services and to be able to, to collaborate and to share resources in order to do this. But they're, understanding the budget constraints that we're under, the task force recognized that it's probably too soon for us to go in that direction. And so the task force wants to continue working to help refine what the standards of good practice are for guardianship and, to look at further ways that resources can be leveraged to perform these services. So with that, that's my introduction of this bill. And Jeff, do you want to add anything about that? Perhaps the committee should know. We have reported on the work of the committee to previous committees, but most of you were not on the committee to hear it. And
I think I was the only one representative.
Yeah. And maybe Representative Frederick, did you hear this at the tail end?
Oh, good.
Yes, thank you.
Well, I'll just be very brief. Chair Tomei, committee, I'm Jeff Brandon, retired member of Governor's Commission on Senior Services and also this task force on public guardianship. So really just quickly I want to say that we studied what exists in this state over the past 2 years, what has existed in this state for many years, but we focused on it during this past 2 years. And the point is that guardianship costs money, and conservatorship costs money, even on a private basis. So if you're talking about your own family or friends, the point is you need an attorney. So there's attorney fees, there's filing fees, and basically a simple guardianship is probably going to cost at least a couple of $1,000s. And if you do a conservatorship also, that's probably another $1,000. So the point is, if yourself or family members or friends needs a guardian, it costs money, and that's fine if the money can be found. But there's a large segment of this state that can't afford that, and that's the thing behind the public guardian concept. So we looked at various nonprofit agencies in the state that do guardianship for low-income and low-asset people. And what we found was that even those agencies are going out of business because they can't afford to operate. So, like, for instance, a small group in Coos Bay or in Grants Pass or even in Clackamas County, they have to start taking private cases in order to stay afloat. And see, private cases can pay the fees, but this is not the point. The public guardian concept is that the individual county takes the cost of this, and the staff person is the legal guardian, which is what happens in Multnomah County. So anyway, I'm just telling you that there's a complete lack of services in this state for guardianship for poor people. That's the essence of what I'm saying.
Thank you.
My name is Claudia. Am I getting on the microphone? Okay. My name is Claudia Burton, and I'm a circuit court judge here in Marion County. And I'll be very brief. I came to Marion County as a pro tem judge in 2000 and became a circuit judge in 2004. And during all of that time on the bench, I've had substantial responsibility for guardianship and conservatorship cases. I can tell you that the need is great. We see many, many, many heartbreaking cases where senior services goes in and we have an elder or a disabled person and they're being abused or neglected or self-neglect, and they're found in just horrifying horrifying conditions, urine, feces throughout the house, sleeping on beds that are covered in urine and feces. I could go on with the horror stories, but I will spare you. And unfortunately for many of these folks, there is no family member available to serve. They are not able to help themselves. They do not have the financial resources to hire a professional guardian and conservator. And what happens now is different from county to county. I can tell you that in Marion County, we scramble. We have some attorneys and professional guardians that will take some of those cases. All of them probably have more of them that they can afford to do. We have cobbled together a local program with some money from the hospital and a few other agencies that provide some funds for a few of those cases to be taken on a reduced fee basis. But certainly the need is still substantially greater than what we're able to serve. It's been my pleasure to serve on this task force for the last couple of years. We have all volunteered our time. I've driven to Portland on my own dime, and all of us have. And we know that we don't have any rabbits to pull out of the hat or any magic solutions, especially in this budget environment. But we do hope to be able to give you, if we have a little more time, again, to volunteer our services, we do hope to be able to give you some kind of recommendation about perhaps something that can be done. Maybe we can't fix all of the problems, but maybe we can design something that will help some people. And if we're able to do that, that will be a huge accomplishment. So I thank you very much for your time today, and I hope that you'll let us continue our work.
Thank you very much. Do you have any concluding remarks, Representative?
We'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have about the situation or, you know, the program, the challenges.
Any questions?
And let me just add that many of the individuals in this situation are actually institutionalized, and in fact, some are in our Oregon State Psychiatric Hospital, people who are in need of a guardian, and we had some conversations last year about the challenge of there are some people who would be eligible to be moved to a less secure setting, but they don't have a guardian to oversee that. Now, you know, that obviously raises a lot of issues, and it's something that the task force has been wrestling with, because, you know, you have to balance the civil rights of the individual with the need for them to have someone to oversee their decisions, and you know, finding that balance is really something the task force is still wrestling with.
Representative Widener.
You actually were getting to my point there a little bit, is what the task force did in this first 2 years and the person's rights, because they may not want a guardian, they may want to be doing things themselves. How is that determination made, whether or not they're capable of making that decision themselves?
Yes, please.
Well, for anyone in the state of Oregon, whether through a public guardianship program or any other form of petition for guardianship, ORS Chapter 125 governs that. It requires proof by clear and convincing evidence that the person is incapacitated, and there is a statutory definition of incapacitated that essentially means that their ability to receive and communicate information is impaired to an extent that, and I cannot remember the exact words of the statute, but impaired to an extent that essentially their life, health, or safety is in serious danger. And there's a somewhat similar standard for conservatorship. So the burden of proof is clear and convincing evidence, and you really have to convince a court that this person is going to be at very serious risk of life or health if a guardian's not appointed. And that's true, again, across the board, no matter what context you're looking at guardianship in.
Representative Thompson.
Do you have any estimate from history about what this might cost? And I ask that question because I'm very, very concerned about where we're going with senior and indigent services in this upcoming budget. And if it's very much, you know, we're going to send it to Ways and Means for the axe job. And I think it's something we need to weigh as to whether this has a possibility up against what we're looking at.
Yeah, well, let me just say, I mean, this bill just recreates a task force, and, so there, Actually, I'm not sure that this really needs to go to Ways and Means.
That's
since
good news.
There's really no cost to what, you know, what is being done. I think the task force was hoping that, unlike last session, there could be some kind of staff support, but I that seems probably unlikely in this budget climate. Ultimately, I think the goal is that there will be some kind of coordinating office established, and we'll have to find a funding vehicle for that. But that will depend on just what model we settle on. Some states have this office within their DHS entity, and the task force has decided that that is not a good model to follow. And actually, national standards suggest that that's not a good model to follow because you get into conflict of interest kinds of situations. And so it really is best to have it as a more independent entity, sort of like our long-term care ombudsman program, so that... the concerns that I think Representative Widener was pointing to, can be alleviated, that decisions are not being made just because of the convenience of a state agency, for example.
Thank you.
Yes.
I would note that we have a subsequent, technically, on it right now.
Right.
And Jennifer, I'm checking with you. We're waiting for an analysis that we would probably be, as you mentioned, minimal or zero. Is that right?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. And if that is the case, then we would request that referral be rescinded.
If I could just say, and again, at this time, all we're talking about is continuing a task force that's really not costing the state anything. But if part of your concern is that you're going to continue a task force that's then going to come back and say, now we want you to spend a whole bunch of money, I would just say
concern is just for this next triennium. Yeah.
Okay. Then I'll just say very briefly that we do believe that ultimately, although any program, I'm not going to kid you, is not going to be free, there will also be some cost savings because of an ability to do things like get some folks out of institutions or deal with folks who otherwise wind up in jail or calling 911. So
we do have some evidence to suggest that we could, ultimately move some people out of the state psychiatric hospital to care that would cost, as much as $80,000 less a year, for that individual. Obviously, there are potential savings there.
Any other questions for this panel? Are there any other folks that we need to hear from that you know of on this bill?
I don't think so.
Anybody in the committee room?
I think Mary's just hiding back
there. All right. Mary, well,
did you want to say anything?
No.
Great.
Then we'll thank you all three for coming.
Thank you very much.
And I'm going to close the...
Thanks.
Thank you. I'm going to close... Jennifer, you act like you know me. I'm going to close the first hearing on House Bill 2237. And Matt, Co-Chair Tomei has asked us to stand down just for a moment, so we'll just hang on for a second with your patience.
going to be going out of order. There will be some bills we're going to hold over until the next meeting. That would be 3250. Do I need to gavel in and out? Or just state them?
You can just state them.
Okay, 3250, holdover. 2928, holdover. 3375, holdover. 3536, we're holding over. And 2600, we're holding over.
All the committees are doing this.
So we'll hear that this morning. We'll do a work session, but we're not going to vote.
Agreed. That's
okay. And with that, I am going to open up the work session on 3110. And we will have the public hearing on 3482 and 3064. Sorry. And we will, in fact, 2107, she just asked. Oh, no, we have to do that. We will have that work session, but we have to wait for Representative Greenlick. Okay. Anybody have any questions about that? I have questions about it. Okay. Let's open up the work session on 3110. And go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3110, in its original format, removed the sunset provision on the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission. It adds ex officio members to the commission regarding the Department of Human Services, Oregon Youth Authority, State Commission on Children and Families, and Oregon Liquor Control Commission. It designates the commission to establish pilot programs in Oregon communities to phase in and implement long-term treatment plans and prevention programs. It specifies the committee create a budget advisory committee to establish or approve minimum standards for drug prevention and treatment programs financed with state or other funds administered by the state. Establishes a governor-appointed director of the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission to develop a science-based model alcohol and drug abuse prevention program for use in conjunction with the pilot programs. We have had several amendments. The one that is before you that Mary Ellen will be speaking to is the -6 amendment, and she can talk the specifics of the amendment, but it combined the -4 and -5 amendments. Additionally, just this morning we received the fiscal analysis on the -6 amendments. Again, Mary Ellen will be referencing that. The fiscal statement was issued, basically determining that there will be a $1.4 million expenditure to the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission relative to the -6 amendments, and that it's an indeterminate fiscal impact on the other agencies that were specifically noted in the bill at this time.
Right.
So that's where we're at.
And so we don't have a letter saying that it will be sent through Ways and Means, but we'll be waiting for that letter that will come hopefully by Monday, right?
That's correct, Madam Chair. Given the fiscal that was received, we would need to add a subsequent referral, so we'll need to go through that process.
Great.
And hope to have that by Monday.
Okay. Any questions about any of that, colleagues? All right. Thank you. Welcome.
Welcome, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you. My name is Mary Ellen Glenn. I'm the Executive Director of the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you about this bill again. I, first of all, apologize for the length of the bill and the amendments, and I'm going to blame it directly on my lawyer, and I've brought him along to talk about it. This is Terry Meehan from the Department of Justice. So just briefly, the bill creates Director of Alcohol and Drug Policy, which is answerable to the Governor and the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission. It creates a budget advisory committee comprised of the state government actors and the counties that currently spend money on alcohol and drugs to put together a single budget request across agencies so that we can determine priorities for budgets across agency. And again, it's so that various state agencies that spend on alcohol and drugs will no longer be arguing in front of several different committees for their funding for alcohol and drug treatment and prevention and recovery. And also directs the commission to develop and implement a plan in consultation with state agencies and local governments and providers to improve alcohol and drug data collection and analysis. There's a crying need for more data collection and analysis so that we can better determine our spending and funding priorities. And last of all, I can talk at length more if you'd like, it does authorize us to put together 10 prevention or demonstration prevention pilot projects. We don't have the funding to do all of those, but we wanted to put forth the model so that people could see what we think would be the best use of prevention funding if we someday have enough money to do so. And with that, I'll turn it over to Terry.
I'm not sure I want to be for the record after I got blamed. My name is Terry Meehan. I'm with the State of Oregon Department of Justice. Predominantly, I'm an information technology lawyer, and so I can bore you with some of the technical aspects of the systems. But first, I want to start with the bulk of this amendment really is going through and reconciling existing laws required various stakeholders to check in with different participants. So the bulk of the amendments now address that the stakeholders need to touch base with or coordinate their efforts with the commission. So that perhaps is, in terms of volume, the bulk. The most significant part, and the part that I was really brought in for, would be the information technology systems. Before, you've been advised about an open source system that was acquired by DHS, that the effort here is to try to save money. These amendments call for the development of a plan, and really it's a system of systems. And it's really just trying to get legacy systems to talk with existing systems, potentially building out a system that DHS has acquired, an open source system. The state of Maryland is using it and using that exclusively in terms of a repository for data. Nothing in the plan compels this. It forces the commission to develop a plan that looks at these systems so they start talking to each other and they start developing business methodologies so that we can start presenting you with better evidence-based practices so that along with the budget requests, you also have information as to how effective are these dollars in terms of their implementation. Again, we've got, I believe, well-meaning people, but we have folks with limited focus. They all have siloed approach with respect to their systems. The intent of this bill is perhaps to broaden that and make sure that these systems talk, because I think that you need common information and common data coming back. Another piece that we've heard from the providers, and that's coordinating program efficiencies. The providers are tired of one stakeholder goes through a program review and asks them to provide information. Right on their, as soon as the door closes, another governmental entity comes along and asks how their program is working. So the bill directs the director of OHA to try to coordinate some of these efforts so that the providers don't need to go through multiple program reviews.
And OHA is?
I'm sorry, Oregon Health Authority.
Thank you.
Thanks. And finally, in terms of significant, I think those are the largest efforts. But it's important to note that the information technology system is permissive. It permits this commission to designate a statewide data repository, and that's assuming we can find an appropriate vehicle or appropriate place for this to sit. Nothing compels, except for modification of what we'll call API, the interface into a system. Nothing compels major rework of systems. We're just trying to get them to talk to one another so that they can start sharing data and everyone can make more informed decisions.
Thank you. Representative Chris Harker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We don't talk about data all that much here. This happens to be a thing that I like to think about, and I don't want to go into too much detail here, but breaking down silos is something that a system such as what you've alluded to can do very effectively and save us money. You've talked about certain levels of silos. There are larger silos here. So what help has been provided to you in this particular area by the Department of Administrative Services, DAS, and EISPD within DAS EISPD stands for?
DAS is Department of Administration.
I laid that one out.
Okay,
I'm trying to be good.
Good.
EISPD stands for Enterprise Information Strategy and Policy Division within the Department of Administrative Services. There is also a Chief Information Officer, or CIO, in multiple agencies and also one for the state. Can you tell me about their involvement in these conversations, please?
Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, Representative Harker, what we're finding is that the problem isn't so much on the technical side with respect to what EISPD would normally be interested in to make sure that the technical protocol works. What we found has been the impediment is just common data elements, such as making sure that the databases themselves have something we can track an individual across databases.
Similar schema.
Exactly. And so it's perhaps the next layer up with respect to the interoperability. That's why the bill asked for directing the stakeholders to change their business processes. So if we can identify a common state identifier that may make it a lot easier to start providing good information, then we can produce more reliable and accurate information for you. So in direct answer to your question, we didn't feel the need to consult with the EISPD. We do identify them in the bill as a stakeholder to be included to make sure the state systems talk. We also want to make sure the provider systems will talk as necessary and county systems will talk as necessary.
Representative Weidman. I'm sorry, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, just really briefly.
Sure.
Sorry. You'll get your turn. Admirable goals, and I'm trying to make some policy decisions and implementations at the higher level to facilitate things just like that. That's why I had to ask you for that. So thanks for your answer. I'm finished.
Thank you. Representative Weidner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is probably going to be more on your lines because I'm going to stay on the technical side of this too. In implementing quite a few things and trying to tie into enterprise systems, lots of times you'll run in and see that the enterprise system isn't set up properly, doesn't have the hierarchy structure to receive data back to it. Are we going to run into issues like that? Because these can turn into very costly projects really fast, and sometimes you're better off, hey, let's just have this program in our own department and not do even communicate back with DAS or anybody else because they didn't set up their hierarchy structure properly when they put the program in place.
Co-chairs, Representative Weidner, that's exactly what the bill permits. Even if we need to have a sneaker network where instead of having the computer systems talk, the statute will now authorize the commission to force folks to, even if it's walking those CDs across the street, to share the data. So if we're able to identify a good system where we can run and do the analysis, we can run the information on that database. If it turns out that one agency has data A, another agency has data B, we can force them to share the information and maybe put it with agency C so that we're able to get adequate information. So even if the systems don't work, the idea is to force people to still share data, even if it means physically walking the data around. We're looking for potential low-budget solutions.
Yeah. Because this is actually, Madam Chair, if I may, a big issue that actually a committee we should have is an information technology committee in this building dealing with this type of stuff, because I walked into lots of different agencies. Not necessarily state agencies, but other governmental agencies where, oh, it's easier, let's just set it up this way so we don't have to do all this hierarchy. Well, then they're missing all the components, all the ties, and it's tough to communicate with systems like that when they weren't set up right and have the proper structure in the beginning.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Weidner, we actually belatedly in one of the amendments added a commission member with expertise in information technology because we realized we could use it as it. So.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to jump in here on this data conversation. Unfortunately, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Join the club. Any other questions? This, of course, has to do with alcohol and drug addiction services, and really has a lot to do, obviously, with IT also. So thank you so much, and we will be having, we'll carry this over till next Monday, and we'll have a letter that refers this to Ways and Means. But thank you so much for working
on this.
Thank
you for your time.
And we have a very thick file now.
Thank you.
With that, we will close the work session on 3110. We'll carry it over until Monday. And we are going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3482. Jennifer.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3482 requires Oregon employers who employ six or more individuals to allow eligible employees to take unpaid leave to address issues arising from harassment or sexual harassment. It delineates unlawful employment practices from an employer, and as requested, requires employers to make reasonable safety accommodations to the victim of the harassment or sexual harassment. It allows a state employee in an unclassified or exempt position who is not a confidential manager or supervisory employee to be accompanied by an individual selected by the victimized employee to be present during any interview between the employer and employee. We have, as of yesterday, received a -2 amendment which was provided to you. I know Representative Wisnett is going to be coming to testify on the bill. We're contacting him to let him know as well.
Okay.
So this is his bill and his amendment. So.
Okay. And we have a group of people who will here to testify on
Correct.
Shall I call them first or wait for Representative Wisnett?
You could go ahead and call. He's probably when he comes. I think he's on his way down.
Okay. What is this? Oh, same time. Vance Day, Kevin Lafke, and Larry Linder. Good morning.
Good morning. Co-Chair Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam, representatives, thank you for hearing this bill. I'm a lawyer here in Salem. Vance Day, Salem, Oregon.
Kevin Lafke, attorney, Salem, Oregon.
And Larry Linder, attorney, Salem, Oregon.
Thank you.
It's probably not unusual that you have lawyers appear before your committee, and they probably always say, we'll keep this brief, which I think is a bit misleading, but we will try to do that. My practice has in the area of primarily litigation, and over the years I have people call me and they say, this happened at work, and I talk to my employer and they ask me some questions, and they said, did the person touch you sexually? And the client will say, the potential client will say, no, they just called me and harassed me. And so there's a difference between sexual assault and sexual harassment, which includes, of course, you have to have a touching. And so we think this bill solves that problem a bit. It's not an anti-employer bill by any means whatsoever. It's a victim's bill. I'm an employer. I employ a good number of people, and we try to approach these matters with great sensitivity should they occur to an employee. So we urge that this bill be sent onto the floor with the due pass recommendation, because it does cover some areas that are currently not covered. That's all I have.
Thank you so much. Representative, do you want these three gentlemen to speak first, or would you like to speak?
Go ahead.
Okay, go ahead. And announce your name.
Again, Kevin.
Madam Speaker, I'll do
Rebecca. Sure.
Madam Speaker.
That's good enough.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Co-Chair Gilliam. How are you today?
Nicely. Fine. Nice to see you.
Committee members, it's an honor to join your chair in sponsoring this bill. I think it's an important bill to a certain section of our population that we provide this protection to them. I'd like, Madam Chair, to talk about the -1 I support. The -2, we're still having some discussion, and you'll have to
to iron that out. Legislative Council talked to me, and they're concerned, and I think I have some concern. I want to support the constituent that brought this forward, but I'm concerned about C on dash 2. We changed it when 1, it says an individual who has obtained a court's stalking protection order, who's obtained the order from the court. And dash 2 says who may bring a civil action. I've been advised that the good citizen that brought this forward thinks that it's covered in elsewhere that the person is going to take some action to do this. But I'm concerned that, and Legislative Council was concerned that the dash 2 paragraph C may be open-ended for an employer. That when you go, but the action of actually getting the order from the court, which doesn't take long, would be some protection for the employer to be sure that the citizens is pursuing this action. So I appreciate you hearing the bill. I hope the bill will pass. I hope the committee will talk about this issue between the dash 1 and dash 2 and reach the best solution.
Thank you, Representative. We don't have the dash 1, and we will get that by the next time, next meeting, but we do have the dash 2.
And thank you for...
And thank you. Before you leave, any questions?
What was your name again, sir?
State Representative Gene Wilson, House District 53, for the record. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you for clearing that.
Your Madam Chair is always good about that.
Thank you.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Kevin Lafke, Salem, Oregon. I've represented many employers and hundreds of employees in my private practice in both public and private sector work, and the bill is a modest extension of existing law. The trend in both state and federal law, including in the federal courts, is to try to protect people who have been the victim of a third party from being adversely affected in their employment. And that's essentially what the primary purpose of this bill is to protect people who have been victimized in some fashion, not by their employer, but by a third party, and protect them in their employment relationship. And I think this is a modest extension of existing Oregon law in that respect. And certainly anyone who's been the victim of harassment or sexual harassment should be protected in their employment status. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Lafke.
Yes, Larry Linder, Salem, Oregon. I'm also an attorney here in town. I've been doing employment-related work for about the last 10 years now. And there's a couple points that I wanted to make with regards to the bill. Right now, when you have an employee who's suffered sexual harassment in the workplace, if they need to take time off of work for that, their only remedy is to try to get a doctor to give them a certificate for Oregon Family Leave Act. This would provide another avenue for an employee that feels like the sexual harassment was of such a nature that they need to get some time off of work for that. And specifically, I've had clients in the past that after suffering sexual harassment have quit their jobs because they had no mechanism to get leave and they needed to get time off of work to deal with those issues. So I think that, you know, a bill like this would help those individuals be able to get the time off of work that they need so they can continue with their employment rather than resigning their employment.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Widener.
This could be for any one of you. If the person that committed the harassment against him is still there, how much time off would be needed? Because if the person's still there, they're always going to carry that animosity or have something inside. So I'm just trying to figure out what the purpose of the bill is, other than giving somebody unpaid leave.
I think it's certainly possible that the third party could be a coworker. And that's sometimes what happens, and that's an issue that this bill is specifically intended to address. And obviously the nature of that very triangular relationship creates a problem for the employer and both the workers. But under existing law, oftentimes the victim is the odd person out in that three-part triangle where the victim loses their employment or the victim is forced to make a decision between their employment or being subjected to the harassment. Admittedly, these are difficult issues for employers to resolve, and I've seen it several times where an employer has to referee in a situation where an employee has gotten a stalking order, a restraining order, existing legal protections, and that's always going to be a problem for the employer. I think what this bill does is gives the victimized employee at least equal rights to the employer and the perpetrator.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Just a question for the administrator. Did the committee receive a copy of the former labor commissioner's letter from Jack Roberts? I think he was emailing that in.
I did not receive that, at least before committee, so they have not.
Okay, I'll submit that then.
Okay, please do.
Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you. Gentlemen, why don't you stay in the room for a while? We have three more people to hear, and we may have more questions for you. Terry Mizak, am I pronouncing that correctly? Sybil Hebb and J.L. Wilson. Just announce yourself, please, and you can just go ahead.
I am Terry Mizak, Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, and representatives of the committee. Thank you. And special thanks to Chair Tomei and Vice Chair Thompson, as well as Representative Wisnat, for sponsoring this bill. In 2009, the legislature ensured job protections for victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking through enrolled Senate Bill 928. Among other things, those job protections include reasonable safety accommodations, as you were discussing, Representative Widener, and the option of unpaid leave and prohibitions against unlawful employment practices. With Senate Bill 928, the legislature took a giant step, catching the law up to the reality of what happens in the workplace. By including these same protections for victims of sexual harassment and harassment, it will move even closer. It's not easy to appear before you today, but I am an actual example of why House Bill 3482 is essential. After I began employment as an administrative law judge for the Workers' Compensation Board, my immediate supervisor, the male presiding administrative law judge, scheduled an out-of-town meeting with me during the Oregon State Bar Convention. At the meeting, he was extremely intoxicated.
This is Isaac. I'm sorry. I know you have a case pending, and I'm a little uncomfortable with you telling us the specifics of your situation.
You mean a claim before Boley?
Right.
Okay. I will skip over specifics as much as I can.
Great. Thank you.
But regarding the case in general, I did file the claim as required by the law and reported the harassment and sexual harassment. And instead of taking steps to top the harassment and sexual harassment, I believe that the state sought to protect the perpetrator. They retaliated against me in multiple ways, and I'm addressing this because of the specific provisions of the bill, including not allowing me to have a representative present on this sensitive and stressful subject. The ultimate retaliation was termination on pretextual bases and in a manner designed to discourage other employees from reporting harassment and sexual harassment. Had a law as clear as House Bill 3482 been in place, I don't believe the state would have terminated me, and I could have pointed to it to stop the state's other retaliatory acts. I believe the legal difference between me and a victim of domestic violence who is covered under the law enacted in 2009 is that I refuse to engage in sexual relations with my supervisor. But the impact is the same, just like domestic violence victims. I needed the safety accommodations. I needed a right to leave to pursue protection of my family. I needed protection from the unlawful employment practices. I needed someone with me as my representative throughout this ordeal, just like the job protection my legal assistant has. There are some who might say that victims of harassment and sexual harassment have other remedies and this bill is unnecessary. I'm living proof that we do not. Not only are the other remedies speculative, House Bill 3482 is drafted to protect Oregon workers and prevent unlawful employment practices. So sexual harassment and harassment victims won't have any need to pursue other possible remedies. Victims of sexual harassment and harassment are too often silent. Many, many are afraid to report it because they then become the victims of ridicule and retaliation. I'm informed there are other victims that would like to speak up, yet they are prohibited from testifying by the confidentiality clauses employers insist on in settlement agreements. Within the small state agency where I worked, four individuals told me they refused to report on-the-job sexual harassment because they would lose their jobs with and be blackballed by the state. With the state as the largest employer in Oregon, where are they going to find work? Finally, regarding the proposed Dash 1 or Dash 2 amendments, I think that Representative Wisnat and I are on the same page. We would like the legislative intent to clearly protect stalking victims under either the criminal or civil statutes, and that amendment was intended as a housekeeping measure. And Representative Wisnat was referring, I believe, to the checks and balances that appear at page 3, lines 9 through 13, or page 4, lines 8 through 11, which the employer can require a third party who is a professional to verify the claim. I respectfully ask that House Bill 3482 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Any questions? It's sort of difficult because of her personal situation now, but any questions sort of on the merits of the bill? All right. Thank you. Thank you. Sybil.
Excuse me. Co-Chair Tomea Gilliam and members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today. Mostly for, in case the committee has any questions, as I was involved with the passage of the bill last session and the session before that provide relief for victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. And so that bill or that set of bills that creates the current relief under Oregon law is very important to clients of the Oregon Law Center. When a person who is a victim through no fault of his or her own, by the actions of a third party, and that incident and experience puts the victim's employment at risk, it's double chaos for that victim. And if they're struggling to cope with the impact of a crime and the impact of that victimization, and at the same time also struggling with the threat of the loss of their economic security, the impact is exacerbated. And so for those reasons, we were supportive of the current Oregon law, and those general principles, I think, can be fairly applied to any circumstance in which there has been harassment or sexual harassment. I don't have any comment on, and I'm not familiar with the facts of any particular cases here, but I think that some of the same principles can be applied. And so for that reason, we're supportive of that principle. I checked neutral as my sign-up because I wasn't familiar with what the amendments were for the bill. The definitions of how one would qualify are important to us and make a difference, and so we would want to make sure to look at that. But certainly I'm happy to be a part of further discussions about that as the bill moves forward. The only other principle or issue that I would raise is that I do think that the bill or that the law, the current law, is set up in a way that provides relief for people who need it in a reasonable and targeted fashion. It does allow the employers to ensure that they have proof that the person is qualifying for relief, and it allows the employers to put some bars on the relief that is provided. And so I think that as it's constructed now, it provides safety for victims who are employees, as well as some support in allowing them to take steps to address and resolve the issues that have been created as a result of the crime. And it's also fair to employers. So we're very supportive of the current law and appreciate the principles at heart of the bill.
Thank you very much. Any questions of Civil Representative Widener?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Civil, here, one of the issues I have when we get into this, because it's a very delicate situation, because you can paint lots of pictures when you're dealing with bills like this. To me, it seems like things are, our laws are pretty strong where they're at and everything and the protections. But I've seen this hit people the other side. My wife worked with the gentleman that got a get well card to somebody, and it had a cast and basically a kiss on the cast saying, get well soon, sorry about your sprained ankle or whatever it was. The lady filed a sexual harassment claim against him for giving her the card because there was a pair of lips on the cast on, that was on the card. He ended up taking early retirement because of it, because he didn't want to have to deal with the harassment suit. Is this going to open the door possibly for more silly harassment claims like that one, I guess would be the way to call it, because this guy was a very genuine, nice fellow, probably the best employer my wife had ever worked for, and he was ran out by somebody who, what their reason was, I have no idea, but just filed a meaningless lawsuit. I'm just wondering, is this going to open the door for people to do more things like that and then say, oh, I need time off now for this too?
Co-chairs, Representative Widener, to be frank, I'm not an expert on sexual harassment law, so I can answer you with some principles, which are that I think the way that the structure of the bill is set up is that there needs the employer has the right to request documentation from the person who is seeking the relief, the person who is the victim, and that victim would be required to provide documentation to the employer that he or she was qualified for the protection. And the employer, if the employer feels that the documentation is not sufficient, can challenge that. I'm not capable of answering your question about how specifically does one qualify as a victim of sexual harassment. There's a whole body of sexual harassment law, and I don't practice in that area, so I can't answer your question specifically about that. But I do think that there are processes built into the law that would allow an employer to challenge a specious claim and resolve the question that way. So.
Can I just point of reference, I mean, when you get these kind of claims, how many of them are coming from private employers? How many of them are coming from public employers? Do you have a sense of that? And you don't have to answer that right now, but I would love to see some data on that.
Co-chairs and Representative Parrish, I don't know that we would have that data. And frankly, and so we provide nonprofit legal services to low-income people. So the cases, the questions, the concerns that come forward to us come from a variety of different circumstances. Generally, I don't know that I could give you a split. I'd be happy to take a look at it, but
maybe I'll check Bowley, so.
I think Bowley might have a better sense of that that information.
Thank you.
And maybe we could ask that information from Bowley. Could you do that for us, Jennifer?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. Sorry. Okay. Co-chairs Gilliam and Tomei, for the record. J. L. Wilson representing Associated Oregon Industries. I think it's fair to say we support the bill, half the bill, and that is we support the inclusion of harassment in the bill. We do not support the inclusion of sexual harassment in the bill. And the reason is quite simple. The original Senate Bill 928 was intended to protect victims of crime. victims of crime who needed workplace accommodation and potential workplace leave. Harassment is a crime as defined in the statute at 166.065. And in some cases, it probably does protect some of the folks that had been alluded to in previous testimony. Just for the record, harassment includes subjecting another person to offensive physical contact, publicly insulting another person by abusive words or gestures in a manner intended to provoke response. And that also alludes to conveying telephonic or electronic messages intended to do the same as the legal definition of harassment. That is a bright light standard in this statute, protecting victims of crime. The issue of sexual harassment is one that is not defined or defined vaguely in both state and federal case law. It is subjective. It's contingent on a number of factors, depending on whether the conduct was welcome, whether the conduct would be considered severe or pervasive, a number of things that would be in dispute in a case, and therefore how do you trigger the proof elements that this bill requires in order to grant the leave or the accommodation. The accommodation section also alludes to threatened sexual harassment as a trigger for workplace accommodation, and I don't know how to begin to define threatened sexual harassment. So the issue here is one is clearly a victim of crime, the other is a victim of misconduct, inexcusable, but still not unlawful. And so there is a clear line of delineation there that we seek to address with 3482. The amendments don't strike us as bad. In fact, I think we would welcome those, so I don't believe those are a problem. The part of the bill requiring a state employee to have someone present during an interview or a talk with their employer, that is fine. We're fine with that. But the issue of sexual harassment included in this bill is problematic, because then we get into the issue of are we allowing leave and are we allowing workplace accommodation on the basis now of misconduct and however far misconduct stretches as opposed to concrete violations of law. Now, having said all that, I can still probably give you a way out on the sexual misconduct piece, which is the bill clearly allows Boley to designate what a victim of harassment is by rule under ORS 659-805. I'm not saying that we would support them, including sexual harassment in that definition of harassment, but what I am saying is the rules could be constructed to get to egregious cases of sexual harassment that you probably should not have to deal with in broad form and statute. And so what I'm saying is there is an avenue that the bill allows for. I would be vigilant personally from AOI to make sure it does not include sexual harassment in the common form as we know it, which is, but in the egregious cases, I think you could work on language to capture that through the bully process. So that is my testimony, and I appreciate your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Any questions of Mr. Wilson? All right. Thank you very much. So with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3482. Thank you all for coming today. And we are going to open a work session on House Bill 2107. Jennifer.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2107 modifies statutory language to clarify that a physician or provider can disregard declaration for mental health treatment in the state hospital or secure intensive community inpatient facility for those patients committed under forensic statutes. This bill has come before the committee on three previous occasions. We have received the revenue and fiscal analysis, and in both cases, there's a no revenue impact and a no fiscal impact on those analyses.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2107 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Frederick moves House Bill 2107 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? This is a bill we've heard quite a bit of testimony on, and I think we are ready to move it today. All right. Could you call the roll, please?
Representative Greenwood.
Aye.
Representative
Representative Markham.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
She's just here.
Excuse you.
Excuse?
She's just here.
Yeah.
That's okay. We'll get it.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson.
No.
Chair Gilman.
No.
Chair Clement.
Aye. We can, if she wants to vote, we can allow it. If you want to get her. Representative, while we're waiting, Representative Greenlee, would you be willing to carry this bill on the floor?
Yes.
Thank you. Representative Parrish, would you like to vote?
I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's okay. 2107.
I'm a
no. Okay. Thank you. So the bill passes, and Representative Greenlee has agreed to carry it on the floor. Thank you, committee. But that will close the work session on House Bill 2107. And so I've announced all the bills we're going to hold over, right? I don't need to do anything more on that. All right, so now we are going to have a hearing, the first public hearing on House Bill 3064.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3064 establishes automatic joint custody and parenting time order upon filing and service of summons in a marital annulment, separation, or dissolution proceeding.
Okay. Thank you, ma'am. Oh, we have a lot of people to testify. Representative Wingert here?
I'm right here, Madam.
Oh, thank you. Would you like to come up and talk about your bill, and do you want to bring somebody with you?
I do. I'm going to bring Matt Manahan with me.
Okay, terrific.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Matt Wingert, State Representative from House District 26. I can't really think of anything more contentious than the issues that surround child custody and child visitation when either a relationship has dissolved or a marriage has dissolved. It would be very easy to fill this room and the hearing room next door and every hearing room in this building and then the gallery and probably the steps with people, Oregonians, who have been through this process and felt that it was unjust in some way or another, and are carrying the pain from a system that separated them from their children. So I think what you're going to hear today is that the system as we currently have it is too adversarial, and that it needs to change. There are, I think the one thing we would all have in common, everyone who might come and testify who has had personal experience, is that this is a very costly system financially. When you enter it, you best be prepared to spend a great deal of money. So if we keep the system the same, there are some folks that benefit, and they're on both sides of the issue, defending both people in the courtroom, and they're just billing hours. I think that we can do better than what we have in the state right now. I think we can work together as a legislature to pass legislation that will seek to diminish the conflict that I think our current system unfortunately encourages, not on purpose, but just as a byproduct of the way that it's constructed. And I hope that you all will listen intently, as I know you will, to the information and the arguments that will be presented to you today for why this system needs to change. And I truly appreciate you taking the time in the committee today to listen to this very important issue. Matt.
Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, my name is Matt Minahan. I represent Oregon Association of Children's Family Services and Dads America. We have a lot of testimony today, so I'm going to be as brief as possible. I'm here to give you maybe a little bit of history on this bill. It started with House Bill 3064 in the 2009 session introduced by Representative Thompson. It was we're the first to admit that was an extremely broad bill. It dealt with a number of issues, relocation, how the courts and their procedures, joint custody. From that hearing, we were able to get a work group, or the House Judiciary Committee and the Senate Judiciary Committee asked the Family Law Section of the Oregon State Bar to set up a work group. I was invited as at the first meeting and presented a number of issues that I thought that they should visit regarding parenting time. I will have a copy of my report to the State Bar in written testimony submitted to you today. Actually, it's back at the... I'll make sure you get a copy of it today. This is testimony that could be handed in, though. From that, I want to preface, before I say what I'm about to say, I want to make certain that you guys understand, or that everyone understands, I certainly appreciate the work that was done on that committee, and I respect a number of those individuals that I work with here on a daily basis who, I respect greatly. But just happen to be on the other side of the aisle most of the time. But what I do want to talk about that work group, I have great relationships with David Gannett and Susan Graby, and I actually teased them a little bit when they put that group together. When I first saw the list of members on that work group, I said I could probably save everybody a lot of time and write your report for you today because I know what it's going to say. And so with that being said, we were less than pleased with the report. We believe this issue is a split issue within the State Bar. There are a number of lawyers and even judges and parenting coordinators who are either pro-parenting plans or, equal parenting time or not. We do not feel that work group was representative of that particular mix. But you'll have access to the report, and again, I really appreciate the work they put together, and they work with me very closely on that, and they're always willing to bring me in on the discussions, which I greatly appreciate. I'll tell you a little bit about what this bill does and what we're saying. Like I said, we were the first to admit that 3064 was very broad. We feel like we've come a long way in terms of paring this issue back. What we're asking here is to have an automatic rebuttable presumption of equal parenting time upon any divorce or dissolution. And what the problem is we have a system that pits one parent against the other. It's not a men versus women issue. It's a parent versus parent issue. It's whichever parent makes it down to the courtroom first gets to file what's called a status quo parenting plan. And they get to define what that status quo is. One parent A's got every other weekend, no overnights, usually marginalizes one parent. But it's a temporary order. We have a saying that there is nothing more permanent than a temporary order. Because what happens is, by the time that case makes it to court, there's been a status quo or some scheduling set, and the judge usually rules with that, with whatever plan was in place, so that temporary becomes permanent. What we're trying to do is equal the just everybody go to their two corners, and we have equal parenting time until we get to that first hearing, at which time we're not messing with judicial discretion one bit. The judge has 100% judicial discretion to decide the parenting schedule. Now, you know, the problem is we make it a rebuttable presumption, because the last thing we want to do is give one parent parenting time that doesn't necessarily deserve parenting time. So if one parent is an abuser, there is an avenue to rebut that, and in that case, the judge would have judicial discretion to decide. I asked David Gannett, what is the mean time it takes for one of these court cases to make it to court? The answer was, well, it depends on which county. You know, some 15 days, some 30 days, some 60 days. There are some outlying cases that sometimes make it a year. So what do we do in the outlying cases? Well, you could, and in a case of abuse, where one parent maybe shouldn't have the right, a FAPA file could, or a FAPA order could be filed and expedite that case, and the judge then can decide on an appropriate schedule for those two parents. But if we picked a number, I mean, David said 15, sometimes 30, let's say 60, or even maybe even 90. We're talking about 90 days that we say both parents have the right to their children until it can be heard. We feel we're not asking for a whole lot. We've significantly pared this back. And you will hear testimony today about how important it is to have both parents, and I think we all know that, both parents active in the child's life. And you will also might hear from the opposition that they don't like a broad presumption, that we just presume that both parents should be in the lives of their children. And I will argue that we already have a presumption in place today. We have a presumption, and it's the wrong presumption. We're presuming that one parent is better than two parents, and we give that power to one parent, whether it be man or woman, to whoever makes it down first. I'll close by saying, too, there are also some opposition. I get a lot of questions of why would somebody oppose this? Now, I've been down here a number of years. I stopped asking that question. I just am ready for it, because there's a number of reasons. I seriously believe, some people who are testify today that I work with, sincerely believe that the system is best the way it is, and that they truly are trying to protect children and families, and I commend them for that. But I do believe there is a group that is protecting the revenue stream. It's very expensive to go through these courts. And I can tell you a story about how I was in a meeting with a lawyer and some things that were said. But there's certainly a lot of money to be made in conflict cases. This bill reduces conflict. I have to say, I have no skin in this game. I'm married for the last 12 years, happily married. I have two beautiful children. I don't get paid for the work that I do around here, meeting. I seriously believe this system is flawed, and we can legislate conflict. We can pass bills such as these that will reduce conflict in case we take the tools away from the parents. I firmly believe that. I firmly believe 3064 does that. I assure you, if you move this bill, we will help children and families of the state of Oregon long after all of us in this room are dead and gone. And I certainly encourage you to do so. Thank you very much, and I'll take any questions if anyone has any.
Thank you, Mr. Minahan. Yes, Representative Thompson.
We've been through this before, so you know what my feelings are generally on this bill. Is there room in here to further protect the rights of grandparents during this period? Very often, I've got two cases on my desk right now where this kind of thing has happened and grandparents are totally excluded from the system, the time that they might actually be beneficial to the welfare of the children, if no one else. And of course, it creates a lot of unhappiness on their part, too. If you're talking about a 90-day period of settlement rights, can you comment on that?
Yeah, Chairs and Representative Thompson, I would certainly support an amendment that does that. And I can give you some history on the grandparents have no rights and family plans are to meet. Family plans. They have been writing on an ordinance, I forget the number, but it's the psychological parent ordinance that basically says, I've been in this child's life, I've provided care, lived under my roof, that, and we have successfully moved some cases through to where we were able to get visitation on the psychological parent, but that is those cases are becoming fewer and fewer. So that has been eroded, and I'll get on your schedule, and I'd certainly be happy to sit down with you or any of the opposition or anybody concerned and figure out how we could enhance involvement from grandparents, because a lot of the times that's who the saviors are in some of these cases, the grandparents, and they have very little standing in the system today. So I would certainly support that amendment.
Follow up?
Yeah, just a comment. It's been my experience in a number of cases that oftentimes it's the parent or the children and the grandparents who are the victims of these battles, and they're the ones that could probably contribute the most to keeping an even keel with the children, keep the children aligned with the grandparents during an otherwise tumultuous period. I think there is some real benefit to doing that. And as a grandparent, I'm very sensitive about grandparents.
Oh, I would never go against a grandparent.
No, don't.
You know, in this bill, one other point. This bill is not about one parent or the other. This bill is about the children.
Yeah, right.
It's funny, last session, and he's coming for when and if this bill moves to the other chamber, we flew in William Fabricius, a PhD from University of Arizona, and he's got a number of studies, and you'll hear some data today about how important it is, both physically, mentally, for the children to have both parents. I kind of chuckle at that, because do I really have to fly in a PhD to tell us that? I mean, we know that. If they're two very good parents, they should be involved, and we should be having systems in place that allow that, that encourage that. And why we're here today is because it's just the opposite. We have systems in place that discourage. I'll admit, I see a number of cases, and the good cases aren't calling me, so I might be a little skewed. But we have a stigma, well, some of these fathers, after the divorce, don't want to be involved with the children. That is not the case. We have many fathers, parents, I should say, who want to be involved with their children, who cannot, because the system doesn't allow them to do that. And they either give up or call me. And that's kind of what we're dealing with here. But it is the children that are the victims here, without a doubt. And that's who we're saving with this bill.
Perhaps you can go ahead, but we have quite a few people, but make it a quick question. Thank you.
It sounds like the system's almost set up to turn the parents into the children, the way you hear it, because they start fighting over, this is my room, no, this is my room. So, and I get the kids this time, you don't get the kids, rather than trying to at least unite them and keep them together out of the good of the children, realizing, okay, we're not able to get along, but we don't want to destroy our children. And the way it's structured now is the children become a tool or an item to fight over.
Chairs and Representative Widener, there are many incentives to have the children, have custody of the children. The state of Washington deals with it. They had a problem where you get the tax credits and the tax filings for the children. There you have custody, you have a lot of say. There is strong incentive to fight and to argue, and that's why we say it pits one parent against the other. We want to take those tools away. and we want to get the parents focused on the children. There are too many tools that turn the parents into children, one parent or the other.
Thank you.
Thank you so much
for bringing this bill to us. Next, we'll hear from Sybil Hebb. Ryan, is it Casti?
Cardi.
All right. And Judge Claudia Burton.
Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Sybil Hebb. I'm here with the Oregon Law Center today to express concern and opposition to House Bill 3604. Before I get started, I want to just express that I do agree with Mr. Minahan and the proponents of the bill that we are all here because we care about the impact of these laws on children, and so we appreciate your attention to this issue. My views differ from the proponents of the bill, and I'll tell you a little bit about why. My testimony, also just for the record, includes a letter of opposition from Bill Howe, who is the current vice chair of the State Family Law Advisory Committee, and my testimony also includes a copy of a report that was done that Mr. Minahan referenced by the Family Law Section of the Bar, of which I'm a member. I practiced family law for the first 10 years of my career before coming to be a lobbyist here in this building, and I did that in Central Oregon. From the Law Center's perspective, as you know, we provide services to low-income people. The single greatest request for assistance from our offices is in matters related to family law, and in no area have I found do clients feel more passionately than when they are trying to seek safe and appropriate parenting time, custody orders, visitation orders, child support orders for their children. So this is a matter of great importance to us. It's of specifically great importance to us because a significant percentage of the people seeking assistance from us are victims of domestic violence, seeking safety for themselves as well as their children. Often that's in an emergency proceeding, but very frequently that also involves a longer-term custody, divorce, parenting time arrangement. And so that's my perspective, the perspective from which I approach this issue. The bill, I believe, would negatively impact children as well as parents by imposing a mandatory order that is a one-size-fits-all joint parenting and custody arrangement. That works great when you've got mature, capable, solid, stable parents who are able to deal with one another and with their children in an effective and appropriate way. Those aren't the cases that we see. And when you have families who are not in that scenario and they are facing issues related to substance abuse or domestic violence or mental illness, or very simply they've been separated for many months and the child may or may not have had any contact with the absent parent, that may be the parent, the father or the mother. But when you have those scenarios that are not cookie-cutter, one-size-fits-all scenarios, and you impose a one-size-fits-all order on those families and those children, bad things happen. And it's our structures, our statutory structures here in Oregon are set up so as to facilitate the creation and implementation of orders that are individually designed to fit the needs of the particular family. And that's just a crucial element to how our family law courts work, and it's important to our clients. It's common sense that an arrangement that works for one set of parents and one family, for example, with teenage children, may not work with another young family that has a nursing infant. And substance abuse and domestic violence and mental illness and other scenarios just exacerbate those differences or enlarge them. And so
the consequences of imposing a shared, mandatory shared custody and parenting time arrangement on families that have those challenges are immense, especially for children. If you have a child in the middle of a conflict between parents, especially if one parent, for example, is a victim and is forced because of this order to negotiate decisions and arrangements with a parent of whom he or she is afraid, that doesn't work well. That parent, the victim parent, can't be expected to negotiate in a way that's going to lead to happy and healthy solutions for that child. And putting the child subject to that ineffective arrangement doesn't make sense for the child in terms of the child's daily life. If a child is dependent upon parents who cannot get along and cannot make decisions, in order for that child to know, where am I going to school today? Where will I spend tonight? Where will I have dinner? Those decisions have a huge impact on that child's daily life. If they're not made smoothly and if they're not made with some finality, that child suffers. And more of the witnesses will talk to you about some of the specific research on this aspect. I'll tell you just a little bit about how Oregon's current statutory structure works. So the statutes are referenced in my testimony, so I'll describe them briefly, but the cites are in the written testimony. Generally speaking, our statutes are structured in such a way that they have important foundational principles and then allow for judges to look at the facts and apply those principles according to some certain factors. That only happens when parents are unable to come to an agreement themselves. And our statutory structures are also set up to really facilitate and prioritize circumstances in which families can come to agreements. I think we all recognize that when there is agreement and parents are capable of coming to those joint decisions, that works best for everybody. And so we provide mediation services, parenting time classes, and other resources that are designed to help parents get to a point where they understand one another's perspectives and can work together in a way that's centered around what's best for the children. Our structures, our courts step in only when the parents cannot, after having had the access to those resources, make those decisions and come up with those agreements. And then the courts are structured in such a way that they look at policies that are specifically codified in the statutes that are designed to enhance and maximize the children's access to both parents, assuming that those parents are fit and healthy and able to be good parents to their children. There are, after that, a set of best interest standards that the court takes into account when the court is making determinations about where custody should be, what parenting time should be, and how that ought to look. And those standards are nationally recognized good standards by which these decisions ought to be made. And they result in decisions that are tailored to the circumstances of that family. And that's when, if you're having a decision imposed upon you, it works best if it's been tailored after considering evidence to meet the needs of your particular family.
Sybil, we have quite a few people who have signed up to testify.
Summarize. Thank you. The only other point that I would make, just specifically to the structure of the bill, is that it would create this automatic order would be imposed. And a person, after being served with that order, would be immediately subject to contempt provisions for not complying with it. If the order happens to be inappropriate in that circumstance, which I believe would be the majority of circumstances, you have a parent automatically faced with, do I suffer contempt, or am I doing something that I think is wrong for the child? And Oregon currently has a provision in its statute, in ORS 107.097, that allows for the imposition of an automatic order, but it's based, and this is a great note, on the specific circumstances that that family has been operating under in the time prior to filing the petition. And so if there's going to be an automatic imposition of an order, it ought to be based on the specific facts of that family. So I appreciate your attention and will summarize. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you.
Thank you and good morning, Co-Chair Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam, and members of the committee. My name is Ryan Carty. I am an attorney in Salem in private practice limited to family law. I am the legislative liaison for the family law section of the Oregon State Bar. I am currently the co-chair of the family law section's legislative subcommittee, and I appear today in my official capacities with the State Bar. The family law section opposes House Bill 3064. Our opposition can be broken down into two categories. policy issues and practical concerns. Before we get there, though, it's really important to break these down into what custody is. And custody is two things. One, the legal decision-making authority, and that's legal custody. And two, the parenting time, and that's physical custody. Currently in Oregon, if a court so chooses, the court can award 50-50 parenting time. The court can do anything it wants so long as it follows the best interests of the children standard that Sybil talked about just previously. What the court cannot do currently is impose joint decision-making authority over the objection of one or both parties. Now, that's sound policy. That's currently what Oregon does. That's codified in ORS 107.169. The thought process behind not imposing joint custody is that if you have two parents who cannot even agree on the term joint custody, and they can't do that up front at the beginning of the case, how are they going to make the decisions that impact the children in a meaningful manner on a day-to-day basis throughout the case and afterward? Things from whether a child joins T-ball to whether the child has treatment option A or treatment option B from a doctor to where the child may attend school if they're entering or changing schools. Those decisions are major fundamental decisions that impact the child. And if the parties can't agree to it, as this bill would force them to do, then it's going to put them right back in court. Now, absolutely, parents who can make joint decisions and who can co-parent are great. And those who can, do. And the statutes are set up that way currently to allow them that flexibility. It's the people who cannot work together that this bill seeks to shoehorn into that collaborative process that is ultimately going to create more conflict. The research that we as practitioners go through and talk about indicates that exposure to conflict is absolutely detrimental to a child's well-being, and that's particularly true in areas of psychological functioning. All the research is absolutely aligned in that high conflict is bad for children. This bill seeks to potentially increase the level of conflict.
Could you summarize, please? We have quite a few people waiting to testify, and we only have 18 minutes.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Let me jump right to the practical concerns with the bill. The problem is the bill says we're going to do joint legal and physical custody without saying what that is. And so we've got two people who probably can't agree who now have to share those things. But what do you do? If mom's been out of the picture for a couple of years and dad files for divorce, serves mom in order to get things finalized, then from the moment he serves mom, even though mom has been out of the picture for 2 years, these people now have joint decision-making authority as well as joint parenting time. But the statute doesn't, the way the bill is written, the bill does not say what that parenting time looks like. And so regardless of this specific family, we're going to impose a very difficult to interpret provision on them. That decision is best left to a judge who can look at the specific instances of this family and determine what is appropriate. That process is in ORS 107.097 through a status quo order, and I believe the statutes as currently enacted in Oregon provide sufficient guidance for parents, for the courts. And the last thing I would mention is that the bar represents both sides of the aisle. We're not pro-mom, we're not pro-dad. We're advocates of good law that makes sense, that minimizes conflict. And that's why we're here today in opposition of House Bill 3064, because we believe it's going to contradict the principles on which our current statutes have been put in place. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Carty. Go ahead, Judge.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm Claudia Burton. I'm a circuit court judge here in Marion County, Oregon, and I will be as brief as I can. What I would like to do is just give you some ground truth about what I see in my courtroom every day as you think about the proposal to automatically impose joint custody as soon as a case is filed until that comes before a judge. And I would
just push that mic back.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I wanted to make sure I was being heard. And I would agree that it will very likely be 90 days or so before that order comes in front of a judge. To the extent that there is a suggestion that perhaps lawyers with a financial interest in promoting litigation are a reason for opposing this bill, let me tell you that most of these cases that I see, one or both of the parties are unrepresented. The lawyers who will appear before you do not even know the extent of what I see every day. And when I tell you about these cases that I see first, these are not the people who agree and sign a stipulated judgment. I don't see those folks. I'm talking about the people who come before me because they need a status quo hearing or a temporary custody hearing or an immediate danger hearing or a trial. And also, when I tell you about what I see, these are not the exceptions. These are not people that I see once in a while. These are the people that I see day after day after day. And I want you to think about whether you want to impose automatic joint custody for these kinds of parents. I see parents who are involved in physical, sexual, or emotional abuse against the children or against the other parent. I see parents who have drug and alcohol abuse issues. I see parents who have had an extended period of lack of contact with the child. I see parents who have criminal history or parents who are actively involved in the criminal justice system while their custody case is pending. I see parents who suffer from mental illness. Then there's another set that I see where both parents are wonderful, loving, functional people, but they have fundamental disagreements about how to raise their children to the extent that they cannot work effectively together. I see parents who have different religious views. One parent believes that the child cannot celebrate birthdays and holidays. The other parent believes if I'm not at Chuck E. Cheese with 20 other kids and the extended family on my child's birthday, then the world is coming to an end. I have parents who have strongly differing views about discipline. One parent believes you spank, one parent believes you ground, one parent grounds and says no TV, no video games, and then the child goes to other parents' house and they have their Xbox and their cell phone returned to them immediately. I see parents who have differing views about extracurricular activities. Dad, in this case it was a dad mom, dad wants junior enrolled in football because he's got to do sports, and mom believes that junior is going to become a paraplegic or have a concussion if he's in football, and junior is better suited to band. And so dad signs up junior for football this week, and the next week mom unsigns junior up for football. Differences about medical treatment. Do we give the kid ADHD meds? Do we not give the kid ADHD meds? So I just would ask you to please, please consider the best interests of the children. Know that courts are struggling with these kinds of cases every day, and ask yourself, in these cases, do we want to impose an automatic joint custody as soon as the case is filed? I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you, all of you. We, as I said, we still have quite a few people wanting to testify. Joe Kemp, Joe here, and I know Denton Rye. Is he here? Denton, you said that you were against the bill, but I assume that was incorrect.
No, I'm for the bill. I'm sorry.
Okay, sure. I figured you were. And Linda Sherman?
She's not here, but I will testify on her behalf.
Well, no, you won't. is there anyone else? And tell me who you are, ma'am.
Dr. Josette Lovemore.
And did I call you?
No, you didn't, but I was asked to take Linda's place.
Oh, okay. All right. I see you there. And you also said you were against it, but I
No, I'm for it.
That was my mistake.
Okay,
sorry.
Got it. That's all right. So, go ahead, sir. And I'm going to tell you, because our time is running low, we're going to give you each 3 minutes. He's going to be the timekeeper.
All right. I'll try to keep it brief. Madam Chair, Co-Chair Gilliam, and members of the committee, I really appreciate the time to sit here. My name is Joe Kemp. I'm from Beaverton. I'm a father of a divorce with two kids. Divorced 11 years ago, was with my ex-wife for 10 years, seven of those being married. It came to a point where my ex-wife stepped away from our marriage, and then filed for divorce on me after telling me on my birthday that she didn't love me anymore and that she cheated on me. She filed for divorce. I wanted to stay in the home, and what ended up happening was she threatened to use FAPA. I've never laid my hands on a woman or on my children. I don't believe in spanking.
Will you tell us, FAPA is
the Family Abuse Prevention Act, and that allows someone to to say, in this case, the threat was, if you don't get out of the house, threatened by her lawyer to my lawyer, that if I don't leave the house, then they will file for the Family Abuse Prevention Act and put a restraining order against me. So that was forcing me out of the house. And the way that works is you're going to be moved out of the house, and then you'll have a court date in the 3 to 4 months, and then they'll prove that you're not a danger, but yet you're out of the house at this point. I love my kids. I've loved my kids since the day they were born, like everybody here would with their family. I'm going through the emotional distress of having somebody cheat on me, tell me on my birthday that they don't love me anymore and they cheated on me. And now I'm being told that I'm going to be stripped from the things that I love and be forced out of my home, which I was. My divorce took a year. We didn't agree on things. And I understand what people say when they say they don't agree on things. But you know what? Married couples don't agree on things. And they have to work through them. That's parenting. But what happened to me was it set a precedence that I was no longer in the home and I got visitation rights on the weekends, which is extremely difficult for me to deal with, as it would be for anybody here. And the rights were stripped from me to have that time that I had. I tucked my kids in at night. I read them bedtime stories. Did all those things that you'd read in books about good parenting. I got them ready for the morning to go to daycare. I came home and played with them in the evenings. And that was taken away. I had to live with my folks for 7 months, 9 months on their couch while I was paying for the mortgage on my house to keep my credit intact so I can have a future for me and my children in the future. The precedence was set. I didn't have my children anymore. And when it comes to court date, the courts do not rule. I don't care what anybody says. They do not rule in favor of the other person when the kids are used to now living with the other parent. I have now been living with that for 11 years, and it has not stopped conflict. It has not. It awarded, whether you believe it or not, it awards control to one parent over the other parent. I'm not opposed to working with somebody. You're not going to agree all the time as a parent if you're intact. And we don't have rules that go into intact families and force them to make decisions and tell them how they're going to make decisions about their kids. They're going to disagree on religion. They're going to disagree on where they go to school, whether or not Johnny goes to football. That happens. That's normal. But then you take my case and you take my kids from me. I have no authority. I've been dealing with that for that. And I'm not here as a voice for myself. It's not going to make a matter whether or not you pass this for me. My concern is all the people that I see today. I'm in a position where I go into people's houses. I'm a salesman. And I see, I've been in the last 9 years of my position, I've been in thousands of homes. I've seen divorces happen between people. And it's usually the same circumstances that fell into mine.
Mr. Kemp, your time is up. I'm sorry.
Well, I just say a few closing things? I don't believe that this bill is taking away the rights of a judge to make a decision on those cases where there's sexual deviancy or abuse. What this is doing is establishing rights for myself and the people like me and for my kids. And I want my children to have the opportunity because they're two boys and it's going to face them the same way it faced me. And I want them to have the right to be able to see their kids 50-50 time while they're dealing with this huge struggle. It's extremely important. Please do not rule because there's deviants out there. There's going to be those, and the judge still has discretion on that. Vote in favor of the people that love their kids.
Thank you, Mr. King.
Madam Chair, Co-Chair Gilliam, representatives of the committee. I'm going to... I'm sorry. Dr. Josette Lovemore, I'm a developmentalist, a consultant, an educator, and a custody evaluator. And I also deal with cases of people who have been hurt by current... the way the laws read right now. And I've written my testimony for you, but I'm going to skip ahead to, in the service of time, to because I hear a lot of people saying there's no research showing that children can live in well-being. There's no research that shows that shared parenting time is beneficial for children. And I present in my testimony that equal parenting time, there's a great deal of research that shows that equal parenting time actually promotes well-being in children. For children to have both parents in their lives and grandparents, Representative Thompson, is very, very important to the child's psychological and emotional well-being. And courts can minimize parent conflict in many ways, but not by taking the rights away from one parent who is a beneficial parent or a caring parent or a conscientious parent for the child.
current research by my colleague, Dr. William Fabricius, out of Arizona State University, suggests that courts have a role in minimizing parent conflict, and this research offers new evidence on the correlation between quantity of parenting time and quality of parenting time relationships in families without severe parent conflict. Nobody's arguing that an abusive parent should have a court order against them, but to have good parents to have their rights taken away is what this bill addresses. And he offers guidelines that court policymakers could give equal consideration to minimizing parent conflict by strengthening parent-child relationships because of their long-term health consequences for children. Children with two caring parents in their lives have better health over the long term. Courts have better options to deal with children's exposure to parent conflict than reducing parenting time because that might risk damaging the parent-child relationship. Better options include schedules with fewer transitions or transitions that do not require face-to-face parent interactions. In these ways, there can be ways to deal with high conflict situations that are positive for the child, that gives the child support by both male and female parents.
Could you sum it up, please?
Okay.
Thank you.
Basically, I feel that my arguments are in my written testimony. You can read them there. So I just feel that the argument for the differences in education, the best interests of the child are served when the developmental needs of the child can be considered, parenting plans that can be adjusted according to the developmental ages and stages of the child, something that the courts could consider. But the majority of circumstances that was presented earlier is not necessarily the majority of the circumstances that all of us are dealing with. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Love. Nitin, I know 3 minutes is going to be tough for you.
I'm actually going to ask for 1 minute, and I'm going to hand it over to
okay.
Teresa. And I'm just going to, you know, some of what, first of all, I want to thank you.
Could you state your name, please?
Nitin Rai, I'm from Portland, Oregon. Co-Chair Tomei and Co-Chair Gilliam and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify. I'm also a constituent of Representative Greenlick, and some of you are already aware of my situation. I've been, you know, experienced a lot of what Joe just talked about. And in my situation, I actually was an equal parent. I was very involved, despite being a business owner. My ex-wife and I worked together. And suddenly, as the divorce was filed and when we went for a temporary hearing, I went from being an active parent to being a completely marginalized parent. I didn't even get any overnights. And that's the issue that we're trying to address. Subsequently, it took, you know, the major issue between myself and my ex-wife was around the children. Because the assets are 50-50, we did mediation, it got resolved. But the children issue didn't get resolved because she got control. And
1 minute.
Okay. All right, Therese.
I didn't mean to cut you off. If you have more, finish up.
Well, basically, it's been 4 years. My children are really damaged. And the empowerment has been so bad that she has violated court order after court order. We've gone to court. The judge on our case denied me due access because she didn't want to deal with it. And that empowered her even more. And none of the parent coordination or mediation has worked because she's empowered. And that's what we want to stop.
Thank you, Nit.
Co-Chair Gilliam and Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Teresa O'Halloran. I am also a constituent of Representative Greenlicks, and I'm actually representing...
big day today. House is 33.
I'm actually here to represent mothers, but I'm mostly here to represent children. For 5 years, I was the president of the Children's Rights Council in the state of Oregon, Oregon chapter, and I was called on a weekly basis by both mothers and fathers who were taking issue with all of the things that we're hearing here today. Hillary Clinton, our Secretary of State, once said, it takes a village. I didn't realize, going through a divorce myself 10 years ago, that the village would mean without the mother, and certainly the village should never be without the father. I firmly believe that there's a lot of abuse of our system. My mistake, if you will, in my divorce 10 years ago was that I didn't beat my ex-husband down to the courthouse fast enough to file a FAPA. FAPA is being abused every day. FAPA, Family Abuse Prevention Act, should be really renamed the Fastest Avenue to Prevail Act in divorce. This is a serious problem. This bill, 3064, will help mitigate that. I have personally been sat in many courtrooms and monitored cases where I've seen the judge use full discretion and be able to give parents equal parenting time. This bill allows for that out of the gate. This bill does not take away the judicial discretion to take care of some of those parents that should not have their children 100% of the time, never mind 50% of the time. So I encourage you to take seriously this bill, to allow it a work group. You know, we hear about the tragic cases that occur. There are tragedy and harm going on with children that cannot see both parents in 80% of the cases. Those are the cases that we're asking you to consider here today.
Thank you very much. Our time is up. And thank you, folks, for staying. I know we've got more people. I know I've got one. Thank you for staying. If you can stay a few more minutes, we have several people who have signed up early on, and I want to make sure that they have time to speak. Can people stay? I know other people had other meetings.
I want to make one comment.
Comment or question?
Comment/question.
Do you want to ask one of the speakers?
Well, you know, I appreciate what the testimony that the judge brought forward. I appreciate the testimony that the parents are bringing forward, and I'd like to see that group really work together so we can bring this back. I think it's critically important that we solve this problem, and I say that as somebody whose mother took them and left, and 13 years with no father because the system in Oregon failed our family. So having a testimony, having a custody order, and saying, well, here it is, and you get the weekends. Well, on one weekend, we didn't show up. We moved to another state. If my children had to vote one of their parents off the island, I think it was going to be me, that they want their dad, and that they would pick their dad any day over the week over their mother, and that's, you know, he's wonderful. So how do we make sure that people who are wonderful parents, moms and dads, and I've got siblings who probably shouldn't have their children, but how do we make sure that we address this so that the parents get heard? I'd love to see you all work together to solve it so that the people who really shouldn't be parents or, you know, don't have those kids, but the people who are just, we're going to fight over football, find a way to figure that out so that, because my dad might have been a good dad, but I don't know because I didn't know him for 13 years. So thank you guys for bringing that forward, the fathers in the room. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative Parrish. And we have, I think, our last people. Sorry, Nitin, your time is up here. Janice Gray and Linda Scher. Was there somebody else in that list that I've missed? Is there anyone who signed up whose the list was sort of confusing? Anybody who signed up whom I didn't call? Okay. This is your last time? Okay. Thank you so much. And if you could just keep your testimony to 2 or 3 minutes. I know you have written testimony also. So okay. Thank you for coming.
Okay. Good morning, chairs and members of the committee. I'm Janice Garceau. I manage Family Court Services in Multnomah County. I think the piece that's critical so that I can be brief to point out is that I work in the public sector. I don't benefit in any way from these clients' disputes with each other. And most of my clients, as I believe the judge made reference to, are not represented by attorneys. In fact, over half. And most of them do not actually get in front of a judge. It's really important for the members of the committee to know that most parents are able to agree on arrangements for children, and that these laws are in place primarily to address those situations when parents are unable to agree. One of my concerns about the research that gets presented to groups like yours is that we confound differing sets of information. There is no doubt in the literature that parental involvement benefits children. There is ample evidence that involvement benefits children. There is not evidence that forcing joint custody equals parental involvement. We're really talking about a set of engaged behaviors that parents access to have meaningful relationships with their children, and they do that in every imaginable custody and parenting time scenario. So I think that's an important distinction to make, and the literature makes it very clearly. The other piece that's critical to understand is there is evidence that when parents agree to joint arrangements, children fare quite well. There is also evidence that when parents do not agree and they are forced into joint arrangements, children do not fare well. And actually, conflict between parents increases over time, litigation increases, children have poorer outcomes across the board, especially very young children. And I think that's another piece to not confuse. There's been discussion about children benefiting from joint arrangements. No doubt about it. That's absolutely true, and that's when parents can agree. This law applies to parents who are unable to agree, and that's where the problem lies. And there is very recent research that the State Family Law Advisory Committee reviewed in a lengthy process that was quite contentious, not all parties in agreement, looked through the literature very closely to make the findings that that report made, and you'll have that in front of you. The last piece I want to leave you with is how these laws actually viscerally look in the real world, these situations. I am working with a family currently. The child is now 13 months old. When she was 7 months old, both attorneys on both sides successfully argued that to give custody to one parent or the other while they were in a dispute would unfairly advantage one parent. That child has been diagnosed with failure to thrive. She has lost 3 pounds in the interim. She's in a 50-50 parenting time plan. And I would really challenge folks who would argue that going back and forth between two houses when you're 7 months old and already a fragile child is a good idea for young children. And this child is endangered by this desire to be fair to the parents, which in effect harmed the child. So that would be my concern about these kinds of imposed decisions.
Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for coming to testify. Thank you for waiting so long. And we're losing people one by one, so sorry about that. People have other commitments at 10 o'clock, so go ahead.
Co-Chair Tomei and Gillum, I do appreciate you making time for us and not having us have to come back for a different day, so thank you for that. I'm going to let my testimony speak for itself, and I have a written version of it, and I appreciate the staff person being on top of distributing what I sent in advance out. I just want to respond to a couple points by Mr. Minahan. One is that the statute doesn't create a rebuttable presumption. That's not correct. What it does is create an automatic order that can be challenged by a separate court action and application to modify it. That is not a rebuttable presumption. It is an absolute automatic order that has no provisions for exceptions for circumstances of the particular family. So that's important to understand and to appreciate about this way, the bill. The other thing is that a status quo order is not a winner race to the courthouse situation. It is an obligation to report under subject of perjury the actual arrangements for the child currently and ask the court to support that arrangement until another order might be entered. And that does carry with it penalties of perjury and penalties for misrepresentation of the facts in the legal system. It is not simply what I say first is what goes. So that I just wanted to correct those misunderstandings.
Thank you so much, and thank you for providing written information. Thank you all for coming. This is obviously a very difficult issue, and it's an issue that some of us have worked on for some time. And there is no easy answer, but I appreciate all of you working so hard on this and coming to testify.
I didn't say my name for the record. I'm Linda Scher, and I'm the co-chair of the State Family Law Advisory Committee's Parental Involvement Work Group that made the report.
Thank you. With that, I close the hearing on House Bill 3664, and the Human Services Committee